You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. And welcome to this very special Aloud event, which is co-presented with Claremont Graduate University on the occasion of the Kingsley and Kate Tufts Poetry Awards. I want to salute all the poets and poetry lovers here in the room. It's a delight to welcome you here to the Central Library tonight. I'm Louise Steinman, the curator of the Aloud series, which is presented for free by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. The Library Foundation, if there's some of you here for the first time to Aloud, supports the work, the great work, of the Los Angeles Public Library, free access to ideas and information, which is no small deal these days, so we are very happy to support that mission. And we present great literature year-round in this beautiful room, and we are thrilled to be partnering with our colleagues at CGU and with our dear friend Alice Quinn from the Poetry Society. It was 25 years ago that I founded Aloud for the Library Foundation, and I remember attending the Kingsley Tufts ceremony in this room in 1997 for that year's recipients, B.H. Fairchild and Barbara Ross at that time. And I want to congratulate the Kingsley and Kate Tufts Award for their 25th anniversary and to this year's worthy recipients for joining this distinguished cohort. And now I'm going to turn the mic over to Jacob Adams, Interim President of Claremont Graduate University. Enjoy the evening.
Thank you, Louise. Good evening, everyone. On behalf of the entire Claremont Graduate University community, it's my pleasure to welcome you all to this very special evening. As we get underway, I'd like to thank the Library Foundation and Aloud for their partnership and for making it possible to bring this celebration to downtown Los Angeles. In just a few minutes, we're going to recognize and hear from two exceptional poets. Before they come forward, though, and before we celebrate their accomplishments, I want to acknowledge the organizers, judges, and staff who made this evening possible. And tonight, particularly, I want to acknowledge all those who came before us, who have been faithful stewards of these awards for a quarter century and have made so much of them. Whether stewards or organizers, they are many, but I'd like to acknowledge two in particular tonight and have them accept our appreciation on behalf of the whole team and all those who came before. Our Tufts Poetry Director, Lorianne Farrell, and the chair of our judges panel, Don Scher. As I reflect on this evening's event, the founding of these awards, the history over 25 years, and all the poets who have been honored, an image emerges of awards conceived in joy, born of love, clothed in the desire both to remember and look ahead, awards thriving in the excitement of competition and all it reveals, awards materially investing in poets and poetry's future. But there is another contribution too. At Claremont Graduate University, our job is to understand better how the world works and to use that knowledge to make the world a better place. We do this through teaching and research. We do this through practice in different fields. And tonight, I am proud to say, we also do this through poetry. For tonight, we honor 25 years of poetry and poets who help us see the world in fresh ways and to wonder at its possibilities. So let's get to it. And here to get us started is an individual whose service to contemporary poetry has taken many forms as an editor, critic, scholar, and as executive director of the Poetry Society of America. Please join me in welcoming Alice Quinn.
Thank you so much. There lives the dearest freshness deep down things, Gerard Manley Hopkins wrote in his beautiful poem, God's Grandeur. And that's how I think of the Tufts, Kingsley and Kate, and their wellspring of goodness and generosity. This extraordinary couple who made a pact late in their life together that after one of them died, the other would sell their splendid house overlooking the Pacific and endow a substantial prize for mid-career poets of exceptional achievement. Poised on that long beam between the precious start of a life in letters and a culminating home stretch, which might prove to be full of adventures and surprises. And in fact, this prize has provided just the boost the Tufts envisioned to ensure that the next stretch would be freshly imagined by the prize winners, given the boon of both the large purse, now $100,000, and the esteem of the judging panels over these 25 years. Quote, because the award comes to you at mid-career, Tom Slay, the 2008 Kingsley Tufts winner, has said, and is supposed to be a stepping stone and not a tombstone, it nerves you up to try to write up to the mark already set by previous winners. Kingsley Tufts was a doctor who published a slew of occasional poems in The New Yorker, some of them what we might today label light verse, although I kind of appreciate Paul Muldoon on this topic and is the opposite heavy verse. A year after the big prize was launched, Kate, Kingsley's wife and widow, decided to expand the program to include emerging poets. This prize, for the many years I served on the panel, always seemed challenging to judge. Debut volumes are apples and oranges, and so many are entrancing. It was always difficult to choose among them, although a delight to explore the particular pleasures and rewards of each fresh crop every year, and the selections always brought great satisfaction to the panel. Kate's vision proved inspiring, as the testimony of Janice Harrington, the 2008 Kate Tufts winner, makes clear. Quote, the award is a confidence builder. It's that bit of light in the darkness that allows you to see your way so that you can keep trying to write your best poetry. Without further ado, I'd like to introduce wonderful Lorianne Farrell, the scrupulous and energetic director of the Tufts Awards, who will be followed by Don Scher, editor of Poetry Magazine and chair of the current judging panel. Please welcome Lorianne.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you very much, Alice. I am delighted that Claremont Graduate University can partner with Aloud, so thanks again, Louise, on this auspicious occasion, celebrating the Kingsley and Kate Tufts Poetry Award program's first quarter century. In this audience, I'm happy to see are several of my distinguished predecessors and John McGuire, the president who took Kate Tufts' call. My predecessors who are here, Jack Miles, Patricia Easton, and Wendy Martin, who before me have directed and brought this program to the place it is today, a wonderful place. I'm honored to follow their excellent example as we strive to fulfill Kate Tufts' guiding call to action, may poets and poetry flourish. Now, this flourishing begins with the work of poets, and it ends in these wonderful awards. But along the way, it requires panels of distinguished judges. Our Kingsley and Kate Tufts Awards judges are celebrated poets in their own right. They are CGU's partners in honoring Kate Tufts' trust and striving to fulfill her wishes that the Kingsley Tufts Award go to a book by a poet in mid-career, thus ensuring more poetry to come, and that the Kate Tufts Discovery Award, in fact, discover a poet of genuine promise. And so it is with much pleasure that I introduce Don Scher, the chair of our finals judging panel for these 25th of the annual awards. Don is the editor of Poetry Magazine, the author of several collections of poetry, an award-winning translator, and most recently the acclaimed editor of a critical edition of the poems of the modernist poet Basil Bunting. So please join me in welcoming Don Scher.
An editor never overpraises. I think that's fair to say, isn't it? I hope so. So believe me when I say that the people who made the awards process possible are among the best people in the world to work with. They are, as you've heard already, substantial writers and thinkers and critics in their own right. And so I'd like to thank the final judges for the 2017 Kingsley and Kate Tufts Poetry Awards, Elena Karina Byrne, Brian Kim Steffens, Terrence Hayes, and Megan O'Rourke. And I'd like to thank our preliminary screeners, Linda Dove, Maynaz Sahibzada, and Karen Lee. Kingsley Tufts Award winner Vivi Francis Forrest Primeval is a book that struck us over and over again. It contains multitudes. It is importantly about the process by which the unseen becomes seen and the unheard becomes heard. And Kate Tuff's Discovery Award winner, Philip B. Williams' Thief in the Interior, is fearless and intense as he is. It's questioning, unflinching, and passionate as he is. Experimental when the occasion calls for it, as the occasions of our time do call for it. A book of fierce intelligence and promise. All that said, now we'll hear readings by the winners. If they'll join us, we can present the prize, and then you can hear the work that we are so happy to present tonight.
I'm honored to share the stage with Vivi Francis. Oh, you're over there now. Thank you to Claremont Graduate University, the Kingsley and Kate Tufts board and judges, Alice James Books, my press, the Library Foundation, and Aloud. Thank you. Sonnet with cut wrist and flies. One, blade to the soft and the soft splashed open was a breakage of robins. Two, blood dripped to the floor, flashed on the tile, painted a big toe. Three, the slit would talk back, sweet nothing in a red gown. Four, wrist, noun, the carpus or lower part of the forearm where it joins the hand to explore the joint, window hinged on the edge of the body, to slice it, to peek into the cut and find the ribbon. Five, blood veined by the rhapsodic. Six, a single mouth, its total face. Seven, risk, verb, to expose to the chance of injury or loss, hazard to risk one's life as a mind was made enterable, a boy stepped into, was natural in him, was his and spectacular. Eight, an artery's plucked quatrains perfected through wreckage, a man waited in the pulse. Nine, a man found in the wrist who wanted out, but who put him in? Ten, he spoke the four languages of the heart. He would touch the boy, would 11 hurt the boy and translate his screams into a fifth vernacular. 12, the boy he entered was put into no more than an urn, than a tawdry vessel. 13, sacrifice, noun, a giving up of something valued for someone or something else considered to be of more value, the radius giving itself to the ulna, the man himself hidden in the dark creases of vein rope and contraction, an artery's hierophant drum, the man, 13, stepped out of the dark and into where the cut welcomed the room's wattage, 13, stepped into the light, his face a cut, a black hyphen from which all speech, 13, from which all darkness was made legible, 13, the single mouth, his total face. 13, he would touch and call himself many names. 13, call himself a god, but he was no god. 13, but it was easy to believe him a god, to walk to him and relive how he got there. 13, stutter and suck. 13 was the sound of the cut closing in on them both to hold them there. 13, as before in the dark when no one was around, blood wild with knowledge. 13, the man approached was a knowledge himself, his face the one written page. 13, his option the sole option. He would take the boy, be mnemonic, be what had always been prefaced to. He would reach out his hand, 14, and his fingers. Thumbnail carving the boy's cheek, touched like flies. Thank you. Durag. Oh, darling, the moon did not disrobe you. You fell asleep that way, nude and capsized by our wine, our bump and grind shenanigans. Blame it on whatever you like. My bed welcomes whomever you decide to be. hung mistress, bride's bouquet, John Doe in the alcove of my dreams. You can quote verbatim an entire album of Bone Thugs in Harmony with your ass in the air. There's nothing wrong with that. They meant syllables as you call me yours. You don't like me, but still invite me to your home when your homies aren't near enough to hear us crash into each other like ours. Some men have killed their lovers because they love them so much in secret that the secret kept coming out. Wife gouging her husband with suspicion, churches sneering when an usher enters. Never mind that. The sickle moon turns the sky into a man's mouth slapped sideways to keep him from spilling what no one would understand. You call me God when it gets good, though I do not exist to you outside this room. Be yourself or no one else here. Your do-rag is camouflage patterned and stuffed into my mouth. Apotheosis. We are back to the beginning and have gone inside. The bats have come down, wooden and sterile, to greet the joints, to rearrange teeth and thoughts. Faggot was a thought that snuck inside me, was put inside me, and all the fields inside me turned Greek, meaning tragic, meaning its beasts were hybrid and hard to slay, a faggot and the nigger, a nigger and a faggot, and though both hollered, I couldn't let them go. Still, this is a faggot's tale, and he says, tired of the new prescriptions of the world, I woke to the base of a stranger's Hummer, but thought I remained still in my violent dream. He said, maybe there isn't a thing to keep this blood from draining, yet having felt the heat in me shake like a window, this moment's an unhinging, a loosened fiber, pussy nigger from the Hummer, batty boy in the dream, taking possession of this thinking. So the faggot man said. It was how the word made dark his every corner, faggot, the only definition for faggot, a measured burn at the edge of sleep, to see in his dream a fire ant crawl from the eye of a dead crow, to see himself as the dead crow and not the ant, to know he was the crow when sleep and when awake. It was the sharp of the word that sharpened itself, teaching him how to describe himself, faggot like a new lexicon, and it entered him, became a childhood memory, faggot in a house and a cradle full of sticks lit at their tips like cigarillos. Faggot tied to the wheel of his family's iris and spun and cudgeled. Faggot, where you going this late at night? Faggot, where a pit bull pirouettes another pit bull in its mouth. Faggot who faggots flagrantly his gilded gums with hurrah and haints. Faggot in the fly horde sucking at a corpse supple wound, stitch by stitch until the fabric pops open. Fabric pops open and the wind moves through. Faggot coming in like the wind, how the wind comes again when it can, but different than it had been. A storm that was both weapon and shield until already it had entered where neither any more mattered. I have two more. Of contour, of cadence. Resist, don't. The difference between what one thinks the magnolias say, branches applauding some animal act below, and what they actually say. Nothing between us can we prepare for, only postpone. I have learned to plead and to please. Another difference. Turn your face that way where light no more transfigures you than darkness makes a need for transfiguration. Yes, the scar above your eye, blood had dropped from the wound, a curtain. But I believe we are inside all blue, you said. Listen, neither we nor blue make sky. The earth spins and we utterly are spun. Bound. Thank you so much. Bound. Was it night what lingered where sweat left? salt, where breath touch expired. No, I didn't find stars or the moon in my hair, or grass, or the first traces of dew that I am told cannot compete with a woman pleasured, that I could get her that way and should try to, should want to try. Was a vastness over me like a great system of clouds pursuing each other, colliding into one another like fists that bloomed like devotions, like, can I be only one thing at once? I was told to believe in and became that single vessel beneath which water I would never taste moved. I was shut tight. I was going somewhere, and quickly. Little boat made smaller by distance. Thank you.
The earth spins and we utterly are spun. No, Philip, it is my honor to read with you. Taking It, for Gabrielle Calvacoresi and Jen Groats. I never remember the knuckles, though his hand was bare. Though their hands were bare. I remember the impressions left on this skin, the wilting and the welting. I don't remember the sound, not one smack. I remember the falls, myself falling to the floor or sidewalk or against the brick wall my head met after a push. There were many pushes. Girls pushed, but I punched. Pulled one down by the hair and kneed her as my own head bled. Girls didn't punch until high school, but I had always punched. What kind of girl are you, my father asked. The kind who wants to live, I said. And I did want to, until I didn't anymore. But I wanted the leaving to be on my own terms, so I hit my father back. He owned me like any good country father. He waited for a husband to tame what he couldn't corral, to throw a rope like fingers round a neck. When I missed a boy, finger holds, I remember those. And me making a fist wrongly and punching, and I didn't mean to miss, but to hit the line below the belly, the belt line. Winton broke me in the snow my first year north. I'm still afraid to say his name. I wore shoes too thin for the weather. Who had ever seen such snow? And had a Georgia lilt, like molasses on a sore throat, sugared, raw, and he hated the sound of it. He was black, and I was black, and I was so happy to be in Detroit, and he aimed for my heart-shaped mouth, my gap teeth, my too sweet tongue. I felt the juvenile weight of him above me, like snow after dark, falling steady and hard. He said, I'm gonna teach you to talk regular. And I stopped speaking at all. I kept my swollen mouth shut and a straight razor in my math book, and dreamt of a bat to crack against his chest. A woman like me with soft hands, not hands of the field, but hands meant to stroke and to soothe, needs a weapon. So I studied the art of war and watched boxing, and where else was all of this rage to go? Is this too dramatic? Find another story. Find a lie. In love, body after body fell beneath my own. Though my own was broken, and I made love like a sea creature, fluid as if boneless, though my bones would rattle if not for this fat I cherish, wouldn't you? And I grew to love the heavyweights, myself with one in the ring. Imagine him punching me and punching me again, saying, I'm sorry, so sorry, to have to love you this way. I would like to thank the... Thank you. The Library Foundation and Aloud, Claremont Graduate University, the Kingsley Tufts Award Readers and the Judging Panel, Northwestern University Press, my editors and my marketing director, who's actually here tonight, JD. And I'd also like to thank Kingsley and Kate, and to all involved with this incredible week. Your guidance and your generosity and your patience is extraordinary. I'm grateful and I'm moved. I'd like to dedicate my reading this evening to the city that made me, though I was not born in it, Detroit, and to my mother, Elaine Francis, and my father, George Francis, whose capacity for growth and change inspires me. I wrote this entire book while living in the mountains of North Carolina, Western North Carolina, a place I did not think I would be, but I followed my husband after years of saying I would never follow a man anywhere. I followed him into those mountains and discovered that I had an argument with Longfellow and the pastoralist and romanticism itself, and I began to write a series of poems called Antipastorals. There was nothing that didn't bite in those mountains. Another antipastoral. I want to put down what the mountain has awakened, my mouth full of grass, my curious tail. I want to stand still but find myself moved patch by patch. There's a bleed in my throat. Words fail me here. Can you understand? I sink to my knees, tired or not. I now know the ragweed from the goldenrod and the blinding beauty of green. Don't you see? I'm shedding my skins. I'm a paper hive, a wolf spider, the creeping ivy, the ache of a birch, a doe, a heifer. I have fallen from my dream of progress, the clear-cut glass, the potted and balconied tree, the lemon-waxed wood over a marbled pillar into my own nocturne. The lullabies I had forgotten. How could I know what slept inside? What would rend my fantasies to cud? And up from this belly's wet straw-strewn field, these soundings. Fallen. But... Fallen. But I was never the light of my father's eyes, or any other brother's, that deep husk choir. So there was no height from which to fall. I began here in the proverbial bottom, undertow, base from which one may rise but briefly, like the failing horse, knowing it must now race, must tear out of its rusted gait, must further tear the pleuritic lining of its lungs, let its tongue loll ugly from the side of its mouth. Have you seen such a thing? Its brown coat salted with sweat as it lunges forward and lunges again, forcing its measure not up but out, knowing its ankles could fold under such weight. Its nose opened into another being, sucking and snorting the only thing it takes within that does not judge it, the air. The sweet air. As it makes its way around a curve that might kill it, that will assuredly kill it. Do you see me over there? Of course not. I'm over here, in this hollow, running from my low life. Oh, Father, for the rub of a hand over my back. Oh, brothers, for the gold leaf wreath that might have meant a stroke of my calf. For that, I stretch these legs to breaking. I wrench this belly's hull, dark as all alluvial things are. Lucifer's is a common story, a child's boogeyman. What should frighten you is this. Imagine what he would have been had he not fallen, had he never known the elusive light at all, never been privy to the cords of God's neck. if he in fact doubted such things, believing only in what anguishes and writhes, trusting nothing more than what soils his hands. Husband fair for Matthew. How good to lay with my husband in our stone flat, though there are not enough windows and too many doors. We need another chair. Smaller tables wobble too much for our books and won't hold both of our plates. But we eat, he and I. And the fare's good. I cook simply because he doesn't know how. Never learned. I don't mind. The food is mine, too. He cooks and we laugh. How good to tell him no when I feel like it, and yes, and maybe. And we laugh more, so free he and I, though not carefree. There are bill collectors that threaten, and the roof over our heads, over our small bed, is not one we own. We own so little, but we get by. We go from here to there to here on need, on whim, for desire. How different from my line. From that woman not so distant, who never went anywhere beyond a field of cotton bolls, who lay with another's husband, my grandfather, not so many fathers ago, he who owned so very much, and her. Pinned beneath him, his arms of rope, his body of winter, who laughed only when she cried, his face a heavy drift over hers, her face brown as the earth below, brown as my own. This clapping is going to give me a seriously swollen ego. I'm just letting you know. Chimera opens with an epigraph by the poet Jamal May. She's not maternal, she's dangerous. Now, that's an interesting quote because any one of us who has a mother knows that all mothers are also dangerous. Right? But I'm using this quote in the context in which it was first used. And Jamal wanted to say, you need to, she may not have any children, you need to look at her twice. I have no charms, admittedly. No gold comb can move through this mane. My skin is not translucent, mine is a tale to fear. I know. And though a mother may destroy, she too sees fit to create beauty that would eventually grow into forms I would swallow if I gave in to my hungers. Nothing will come of this womb. But up from my wounds, up from this goat's body, from my wood-smoked lungs, from the milk of me, comes a song, a melody, to open your wounds, then lick them clean. Thank you.
I began earlier by quoting a priest and poet, and I'll quote another favorite one now, once a Catholic. George Herbert, speaking intimately to God in one of his most dramatic and riveting poems. Now I am here, what thou wouldst do with me, none of my books will show. Well, now we are here, here because you, the winners of these distinguished prizes, have with your many astonishing books proved your path, seen your way, as Janice put it, beginning on the Kingsley side of the equation with Susan Mitchell and Yusef Komunyakaa, and stretching to Ross Gay and Vive Francis, and on the Kate side, Vive Francis, and on the Kate side, beginning with Doug Anderson and Catherine Bauman, and stretching to Donez Smith and Philip B. Williams. I'd like to pay tribute to three who have departed this life: Tom Lux, the 1994 Kingsley Tufts winner; Deborah Diggs, the 1995 Kingsley Tufts winner; and Lucia Perillo, winner of the Kate Tufts Prize in 1996 and the Kingsley 10 years later. They've left so much for us to dwell in and praise. and the arrow of beneficent support the Tufts envisioned has hit its mark over and over again from 1992 to the present. Endowed with talent, fortified by high ideals and ample will, nourished by the work of your predecessors and held aloft by these prizes, which each of you so fulsomely deserved, now you are here in this beautiful library where Louise Steinman, congratulations on your 25 years, Louise. Where Louise curates her brilliant roster of programs every year, and we are all here to applaud and celebrate your achievement. So many thanks to everyone, to the Tufts for their miraculous idea, to Claremont Graduate University and the administrators of this great program over these 25 years, and to the poets most of all. So will all the previous winners who are here stand with the 2017 winners for a moment, and let's have a final round of applause. At Zuro, John, Henri, who else is here? Hey! Congratulations. And now, please join us for a reception with Vivi and Philip and all the people, all the other winners who are here, and everybody who loves their work and wants to celebrate them. And there'll be a book signing too in the courtyard.